Hey everyone, Larry here from Talking More Wrestling, and I was asked by Captain Nostalgia here, by Victims and Villains, to kind of give a kind of a shout out, if you will. The wrestling world recently, very recently, has lost again, way too soon, superstar by the name of Ashley Massaro. Ashley Massaro, you may know her if you're in. If you watch wrestling, you would know her as the winner of the second WWE Diva Search in 2005. She was that rocker chick, that punk chick, if you will. And she was Long Island, born and bred in Long Island, which is where I'm from. And I remember watching her on the with the Diva Search contest. And, you know, hey, you know, Long Island native. This is pretty sweet. And I remember as well that, you know, what made her stand out most out of everybody is that she actually gave out her name, her phone number, live on Raw. It was a live call-in. Like we voted on who would win. And she actually gave her phone number, her actual 516 area code, it may have been a 631 area code, but a Long Island area code, live on Monday Night Raw for people to call and say, hey, what's up? What's going on? You know, I voted for you. She was cool. You know, at a time with WWE when they were really just, they weren't looking for as much the wrestler of the women that they look for today, they were looking for models, you know, just, you know, women who look pretty. And look, you know, mid-2000s, that was the name of the game. Ashley Massaro, she was definitely in that bracket. She's done numerous Hawaiian Tropic pageants, which she won a bunch of them. She was in FHM, she was in Stuff, she was in Maxim, of course, she was in Playboy. And you know, outside of professional wrestling, she did do a couple of shows. She was on an episode of Smallville. She was on Extreme Makeover Home Edition, if you remember that. I think it was like a WWE family thing. I don't know. But if you don't know her from wrestling, you most likely will know her from the season of Survivor in 2007 in China. She was on that one. I don't remember. She didn't win it. I'll tell you that much. When did she go? Oh, she went out second, actually, to be honest with you. So she was out day six. But nevertheless, she was on Survivor China. And I remember that was big time, too, because I was kind of like, oh, you know, WWE is getting that exposure that we're always looking for as fans. But, you know, unfortunately, she had recently died. It just came out that it was apparently suicide. Originally, it was just deemed as a non-criminal death. So, you know, ruling out drugs or murder or anything like that. But as the days have gone on, it seems that it has been deemed suicide. She, which I honestly did not know, she did suffer from depression, which, you know, a lot of times in the wrestling business, that can happen. That can happen a lot. Especially when you leave the wrestling business. A lot of times, these women, these men, they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do next. All they know is wrestling. Now, Ashley, that's not all she knew. I think she started starting her own business. I believe she went back to school. And she would do some of the circuits, you know, some independent shows. Recently, she started doing a lot of the autograph sessions. Me, personally, I just saw her about a month and a half, no, not even, less than a month ago, at Chiller Theater in Parsippany, New Jersey, which she was at a few times, you know, signing autographs. She was happy, she was chipper, saying hi to everybody. You know, it's weird to see, whether famous or not, to see someone that close. Like I only saw her less than a month ago, and now I'll, you know, unfortunately, I'll never see her again at any one of these signings. She does leave behind a daughter. I believe she's 19, the daughter, born in 2000. Ashley herself was only 10 days away of turning 40. So it's, you know, Josh talks about it every episode, and as it should be. You know, just suicide, it's nasty. It's a nasty thing. It's ugly. But we don't want to I don't want to remember her for that part, you know, not the end. You know, her career, though short, was memorable. She had a match at WrestleMania 23 against Melina for the WWE Women's Championship. It was a Lumberjill match. She substituted WrestleMania 24. She substituted for Candice Michelle in a tag team match. Again, you know, a Divas Playboy Bunny match, but it's all right. It was a straight up tag match. Funny part about that one is the power went out. WrestleMania 24 was in the Florida Citrus Bowl back in 2008, I want to say. And, you know, if you know that football stadium, there's really nothing to it. It's just brick and mortar. There's barely any electricity in it. WWE dumped like $1 million into it just to jazz it up for WrestleMania 24, and all the lights went out. So they just had a couple of spotlights on them while they were wrestling. And but Ashley, she was, you know, she picked up the business quickly in a world where, again, a lot of these women just relied on their looks, on their sex appeal. Ashley tried, and just recently she was training. I believe it was possibly for a return to the ring. She was training, from what I understand, at New York Wrestling Connection, again, out here on Long Island. So I guess she was getting ready for some sort of comeback, or at least maybe one more match, as you hear. You know, we're not going to get that one more match. And at 39, I mean, way too young for a human, don't get me wrong, but especially in the wrestling world, it's becoming common. You see these guys, these women, unfortunately not making it to 40, to 50. But I don't want to leave this on a sad note. I want to leave this on a happy note, and on a funny note, actually, because the most memorable interaction I have with Ashley was at Schiller Theater a few years ago. She was there. I'm like, all right. Loved to get an autograph. I actually mailed a DVD. She was on one of the WWE DVD Divas DVDs. So I got her fan mail address and, you know, mailed away the DVD cover slip, but never got it back. So I'm like, all right, this is an opportune time to get an autograph. So she just got there. You know, doors open. She just got there. She's setting up. I'm like, all right, I'll come back. I come back. I think it was like $20 for the autograph. 8x10, very simple 8x10. So I remember she either didn't have the change, or she didn't have the pens yet to do the autograph. So she's like, hey, do me a favor, can you like watch my table for like 5 minutes? I'm like, okay. You know, I mean, not that I'm going to sign autographs, but she had me watch her table for a couple of minutes while she just ran off to get, I forget, it was either money or the Sharpies to do the autographs. So she comes back. I'm like, all right, cool. You know, signs the autograph. Awesome. My buddy looked at me and he goes, you didn't pay her. I'm like, what are you talking about? Of course I paid her. You always pay first and you get your autograph. He goes, no, I watched. There was no money exchanged. I'm like, garbage. I would not do that. And I honestly wouldn't. So, all right, you know, we're on our way, walking around the rest of the show, and we're going home, and I'm counting my money. And I'm like, why am I $20 over than what I spent? And lo and behold, I got an autograph from Ashley Massaro, and unfortunately, I stiffed her on the $20. I felt terrible about it, truly. Subsequent shows I've seen her at, I always wanted to go up to her and be like, hey, look, this is what happened. Here's $20. I owed it to you a couple years ago. You know, I'm not looking for another autograph because this is the pay for the first one. I never had a chance to, whether there was a line or she was busy or I didn't have the $20. And we always every time we saw her at one of these shows, always joked about it, always laughed about that. And unfortunately, that's, you know, that's going to be it. You know, it stinks as a wrestling fan. It stinks to see this. You know, just to see this happen in general, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to little that part of it just because she's a wrestler. Just, you know, the fandom that I have that, you know, if you know me, you know, it just stinks when I see any of these men or women suffer, let alone actually go this route. Only because just a couple of days before she passed, she tweeted. She sent out like over she responded to like over 300 fan letters. You know, Ashley, you will be missed. Survivor fans will miss you. WWE fans will miss you. Your family will miss you. We will miss you. And just, folks, just remember, when you think it's the darkest of times, there's always that shimmer of light. Reach out to somebody, anybody, anybody at Victims and Villains, anybody at Talking More Wrestling, any of the podcasts that I do, and the podcasts that Josh do. And, you know, Ashley, again, you will be missed. Rest in peace. And I'm going to throw it back to Josh, and we're going to get this episode going.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I'm your host, Captain Nostalgia, and for this episode, we are going to be diving into some of the artists that are making up this year's Flood City Fest. I'm here right now with a common name.
Yeah.
There's three Joshes here.
Yeah.
This is take two because I lost the original name. You know, technology happens sometimes, but how are you guys enjoying Flood City Fest?
Oh, man, it's sweet. Community here is incredible. It's a little bit of everything. So you can kind of come out and no matter what you really like to listen to, and you can find it here. It's really awesome.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the smattering of art and music and food and, yeah, a little bit of everything.
You said smattering. That's smattering. A funny word.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
I mean, burritos are like, the burritos alone are like new infants. Yeah. Just like thrown on a plate of like potatoes and Mexican, it's amazing.
Burritos are life. Burritos are life for sure.
All right, so let's open this up, man. Tell us a little bit about Dens, who you guys are as people, and the music that you guys create.
Yeah. So am I supposed to hold the mic? Okay. So as far as our music, like if there was one word, probably intentional. Try to be super intentional with all the instrumentation, with all the lyrics, with everything that we do. So like when we put together an album, more often than not, it's a concept album. That's what we like to do, so that it has a cohesive message. And that's really what we're about. I mean, we're pretty explicit about kind of where we're coming from and our Christian perspective on everything. And that's what's important to us. And really, it's not about anything other than that's what's important to us, and so we want to share that with other people.
All right, so I asked this last time, and I got to ask it again so that it's on record. But one of our writers is a fan of your guys, and he wants to know, how does it feel to have the best recorded version of Jesus Paid It All?
I didn't hear that question last time because I wasn't in an interview, so first time I've heard it. Yeah, I don't know that I can accept that praise, but if somebody thinks that, that's awesome. Yeah, so it's definitely the heaviest version out there as far as we know, so I'll go that route.
Yeah.
That feels great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's just the way it came out.
We can't do any better.
Yeah.
We just, that's how stuff comes out. We can't do it any better. Like, I wish we could, but that's all we got.
All right, so let's talk about No Small Tempest. No Small Tempest is the Face Down debut that you guys had, and we talked a little bit about this off-air both times that we've done recording. This has been 10 years in the making, and what is it about this particular album that 10 years of your life to bring it to this point, what is it about the particular themes of this album?
Yeah, so I think deep down... you know, out of all the biblical heroes, I identify most with Jonah. You know, like that stubbornness to, you know, to hear what God has to say and turn away from it. And so, like, we wanted to take No Small Tempest and take the Jonah album, or the Book of Jonah, put it in album form, and tell that story through music.
Yeah, so each song represents a chapter from the Book of Jonah, and like Josh said, we resonate with Jonah because I think we're stubborn people in general and find ourselves struggling with that all the time because, you know, on the one hand, yes, we want to listen to what God says and we know that that's the right thing to do, but on the other hand, we find ourselves sort of bucking against that and feeling that tension internally, and it hurts. And it really has terrible consequences from time to time, and it did for Jonah too. And so, like, as he's learned those lessons over the past 10 years, we have learned those lessons. And I don't know, that just has resonated with us in a way that it's just impacted us in a big way. Yeah.
So the EP tells the story of Jonas, each song representing a chapter in the Book of Jonah. Mm-hmm. It's not often we get musicians on, but I try and prepare when we do get musicians on,
yeah,
kind of familiarize myself with their music. And one thing that I definitely noticed about the writing aspect of the more musical side of it, it's definitely a very technical album. So, you know, putting 10 years into this album, what was it kind of like listening to or even creating the technical and very layered structure of the music?
Yeah, so here's what we did. We said we sat down and we actually read the first chapter of Jonah, and we said, how can we translate this into music? And then once the music was there, how do we translate that in a lyrical format that is broad enough so that it's applicable to anybody that hears it? And so we worked really hard at that. And, you know, I don't know, I guess it would be like if you tried to score a movie and you said there's a super dramatic part, and how do you come up with something that fits that super dramatic part? Mm-hmm. So we felt like we did that with rock music, post-rock,
yeah,
and said, you know, hey, like, how do we turn this and translate this in instrumental form? And so as far as, like, what that looked like, from my perspective as a lead guitarist, being in the studio is the most frustrating and rewarding thing that you could possibly do.
Sure.
It's painful. It hurts because you're trying to get what you're looking for, and you're working with the creative juices of three other guys, and you're in a studio and your fingers don't always do the thing that you want them to do. And I mean, just going back to the drawing board, I think from my perspective, like when I recorded the guitar, I had something like, through the writing and the actual tracking and everything, I had something like 1,000 takes, which is super embarrassing to say on your show because it means I couldn't get it right to start with. It came down to, like, how do you translate this feeling and this message and this thing that has impacted us on an emotional level for so long into something that can be heard? And that's a hard thing to do, even with four songs.
Basically, we're the Hans Zimmer of post-rock.
Hey, Hans is my boy, dude.
Yeah,
crafting some of the best film scores in the last 20 years.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, but when you guys are talking about too, kind of go back to the, you know, the bringing hymns into the rock music.
Yeah.
What is it about the hymns that you have featured on this album that said, I need to have this kind of scored into, or this is where I think that this hymn should go?
Yeah. So the idea with the hymns was, you know, Jonah is, in a lot of people's minds, when they think of Jonah, they're thinking of this crazy story from back in the Old Testament, from, you know, way back in ancient time. And, you know, maybe they heard about it as a myth or something like that, where he gets swallowed by this whale and everything like that. So it feels, on the face of it, like if you've never read the story, it feels like it's irrelevant because it's so much time has passed since that's happened. And so the hymns was a way to connect it to the present and connect it with people where they are, and in something that ties everything together thematically. And so, like, if you listen to the hymns, they connect with the message of the songs that were that we wrote about Jonah. It's really funny how that works. I don't know if you want to weigh in.
Yeah, yeah. So we picked the album is about Jonah. So we've got some water themes up in there. So we picked three water-based hymns and kind of told like a second portion of the story to segue from, you know, track one to track two. We could have split it out into a separate track, but we were very adamant about keeping the four songs for the four chapters.
Yeah. And the other thing about the hymns is, you know, hymns have been used in the church for a long time in congregational settings. So if you think about it like this, the individual songs are the message from Jonah. And the hymns in between the songs, it's almost like we're asking people to enter into the music with us. It's a call and response, yeah. So people are able to, you know, because we're using this congregational or traditionally congregational song with it, it's a, hey, this is what Jonah says, now let's all respond together in that message.
Yeah, we actually, we usually have it on track. We didn't do that today with the sound system. And so we did it a cappella today. And it was
dope.
Powerful.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the first time seeing you guys live. So
nice.
I thought that was a thing that you guys did. But, yeah. I mean, apparently it's not.
Not a cappella anyway.
Yeah, we typically do it, but not a cappella. You know, it just depends on the set, too. I mean, this particular set, we switched things up a little bit to fit the format for today. So,
all right. So this is kind of winding down on my questions for Dens. What is it, when you guys are crafting music, you said that you're writing new music now. Mm. No Small Tempest has been out for a little over a year now, or just about a year. Mm. So are we looking for the future of Dens to basically tell the stories of other biblical leaders?
Man, that's a good question. So other biblical leaders, no. I think what we want to be thematic in what we write, but at the same time, it's not always going to fit the same template. So we write things that we need to hear and that mean something to us. You know, and it's really funny because when you write a song or do any art, whatever it is, you know, the artist, they have their intended meaning behind something. And then someone else hears the song and they bring a meaning of their own to the song. And they take something new into the song and they take something from it, hopefully. And so it's really interesting how that works. And music is just a perfect platform for that. You know, we may mean something completely personal to us in our music, but someone could hear the song and be like, oh, shoot, I can apply that in a completely new way for their life. And that's what we want. Like, we want people to take it and bring that subjective experience to the music based on the message that we have.
So we're getting ready to hear a song from you guys, which is on No Small Tempest, and it's called Dead Rise. You guys want to tell us a little bit about what this song is?
Sure. So this is Jonah chapter 1. Jonah has been given instructions by God, and he decides instead of doing what God told him to do, he runs away. Really, he runs away and finds himself being chased down by God, which is crazy and, like I said, painful. And he finds himself literally thrown into the sea and finds himself in a place where the chaos around him is just too much to bear, to the point that he just almost gives up. And even though he was running from God, God chased him down and provided a way to be saved from that chaos. So it's just this beautiful picture of, hey, even when we run from God, God has the power to come back and rescue us from the chaos that we created because we've been disobedient. And that's something that, like, that's literally my life.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally me all the time. And I hope your listeners really dig it too and feel that too.
All right, so where can people find more information about Dens and follow you guys online and follow your adventures in your ever-expanding career?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So, yeah, obviously social media is always a good place. We're on Spotify. You can go to iTunes. Densandnoise.com is our website. So all of those fun places. And, you know, the thing is, if you guys are out there and really like the song or just have a question for us, like, shoot us a message on Facebook and like, let's just talk, and we'd love to talk to you guys and kind of like hear what you got out of the song, because that's super important to us too.
Anything? Okay. All right. Well, this song is called Dead Rise. This is Dens. We'll be back on the other side of this song.
me to not pass?
Okay,
I just want to make sure.
So I'm here now with Mr. Cherokee Lynn and Jordan from Capra Project staring us down. Go check out our in-depth interview with Capra Project as well. But this guy is from Fort Smith, Arkansas. We're in Johnstown, Pennsylvania right now. What's going on, man?
Dude, this has like been my first Blood City Fest that I've ever been to, and like the amount of openness that like this community has for its individuals and for like the community itself has just blown my mind. Like completely. I've really haven't felt this accepted in like the shows, like the shows at like my hometown really as much. Like I feel like there's a lot more like artsy vibes here, like people like getting, especially with the poetry.
Alright, man, well, let's jump into your poetry. Like, I feel like there's a good number of poets that are here. There's something about yours that I feel like really stands out, and that's the honesty and the rawness to it that I really love. And so tell us a little bit about how you kind of got started into doing poetry.
It started about 3 years ago. I dropped out of college, and I've recently went back, but I dropped out of college, and I was pushing cards at Sam's Club, and I started to just look down, like, deep into myself and did things that, like, I wanted to do, and one thing that I've always, like, fell in love with was, like, performance poetry and, like, just being able to get the thing that you can't really say out. Like, that's always been something that I've strived for and something that, like, I found refuge in. Whenever I got saved, I, like, the first thing that I ever, like, said to myself was I wanted to be transparent. And I kept on pushing and pushing that, like, that kind of boundaries. And a lot of the people in my church setting, like, some of them were very, like, do it. And then there's a lot of them that were very, like, this is very raw subject matter. This is stuff that could lean into, like, negative tensions or negative things for, like, the church body or things like that. So I feel like my entire career doing this has been, like, this whole balancing act between, like, am I supposed to be real and honest about this kind of stuff, or am I supposed to just do what the church wants me to do kind of thing. And there's always been this, like, conflicting force, and I feel like a lot of that shows in the work that I put out now.
For sure, and I think one of the things that, you know, you're really honest about is, like, your mental health struggles, and that's a huge part of your poetry, and that's really why I wanted to sit down with you, is because we are a show that is so heavily focused on mental health and, like, bringing those conversations, because there's a lot of stigma around it. So what, when you sit down to write a piece, you know, what is it like for you to kind of really make yourself vulnerable to share your experiences, whether it's with the church, with depression, or even suicidal tendencies?
It's been, I'm just going to talk about a recent conversation that I had with my wife, actually. I went to the Bernstorff set yesterday, and he said some really honest things, and it opened up this thing within me, and I started to talk to my wife. Like, we actually went to the back, and we were, like, bawling our eyes out for, like, an hour, and I've had a lot of things happen in the last, like, 6 months of my life. A year of my life. We've dealt with a miscarriage, and we've dealt with my grandma passing away, and a falling out with me and my brother, and a falling out with me and my godmother. So we just kind of lined up how we're going to handle these kind of things and how we're going to, like, go about from here, because there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of hurt feelings, there's a lot of animosity between me and my creator that I'm trying to, like, squirt out as I go. So a lot of it, like, writing is, I believe as poets, we're problem solvers. And every poem is a problem being solved. And I feel like that's the way that I tackle it. Like, being able to write and perform it and hope that somebody else hears it is the way that I'm able to deal with those things.
That's awesome. I think that is definitely an area that needs to be addressed. And when you're talking about those kind of things, you know, it's honest. It is real. So I appreciate that. And I think that, you know, as you're talking about, you know, that honesty, that is this for the church, this for myself, this for the people that are in the back of the room that need to hear this message, that might have a hatred towards Christians or God, you know, definitely reflects in a lot of the art and information.
Yes, absolutely. It's been, there's one piece that I wrote this last year. I performed it today. It's called Fairy Tales of Government Propaganda. It's written from the perspective of a friend who, it's a true story too, a friend who had a friend who committed suicide. And it's written about my friend Will, and about a year ago he took his life due to extraneous circumstances and things along those lines. And it's me kind of pinpointing where I was in that moment, and like what kind of things could have led up to that moment, and like how I feel after that moment, and how I picture myself in his shoes in that moment. And it's kind of like taking it all in from like a bunch of different angles. And it's like, it's a mixture of like my own stuff and like my own, like, I feel like I projected my own like suicidal tendencies into that piece as well. Like I was able to resonate with it because I would understand how somebody got to that place. I would understand, and it's me trying to understand like everything with them.
I think too that when you are someone that has those feelings of suicide, and those impending thoughts of what would happen if I just killed myself, and then you actually experience something, it makes you see suicide and mental health and depression in a brand new way. And for you, you can definitely feel that way in that. I mean, I'm sorry for your loss, man. I know what that feels like. Because, like, all of that is just like, where do I go from here? Like, how do I turn all this negativity into something positive? That way, hopefully, someone will reach out and start a conversation and say, hey, you're not alone.
Yes. I think that's the biggest benefit of art, being able to portray that people aren't alone in those kind of things. Like, people aren't alone in their mental health. They're not alone to being in their room and feeling like they're as ostracized from society as like I've felt before. And like being able to show those feelings within performance opens up a complete conversation to be able to talk about it and to be able to share that moment. You know?
Yeah. Alright, so I'm gonna kinda put you on the spot here.
That's okay.
Because I want people to hear what I heard. Okay. So pick anything you want with your freestyle poem for us right now, live on the air.
Anything I want?
Anything. Go for it.
Sorry.
No, you're good. I told you I was going to put you on the spot, so.
Memories consume themselves. Memories feeding off of memories are able to put themselves into assortments. Assortments find themselves in the piles, and piles find themselves in the notes, and notes find themselves in the years. And these years fill up pages, and these pages fill up pages. Where am I in those pages? Where am I in those notebooks? Where am I in those years? You found me. You found me back in an abandoned venue about west of North. I'm sorry.
Alright, you're good, man. Keep going.
You found me west of Greenwood, deep in an abandoned building. My friend's band was playing. I didn't know it was my friend at the time, but my friend's band was playing. And you sought me.
Oh, yeah. So my boyfriend gave me his name, and I spent, like...
And since then, I've tried to sought you. Since then, I've tried to seek you. I appreciate it. Sorry.
Alright, you're good, man. So what's the writing process for you like to kind of make each poem individual and separate and unique?
Let me show you.
Alright.
The writing process is annoying my wife with constant messages and constant just like random things that I just think of, like, their arrest records are looking like yearbooks. And, like, different things, like, because I just, as soon as I think of anything, like, I wrote this, like, it's okay for you to go, because I heard a story about somebody who was going through a similar thing, because I just dealt recently with my grandma passing away. And he said that he would tell his grandma whenever she was getting ready to tell her that it's okay to go, and it's okay to pass on. So I'll get these, like, random things that, like I just put pain changes people. Like, I get these, like, little shrapnels of words or things that, like, pop up in my mind, and, like, it's almost like a Mad Libs where I'm, like, putting them together. And it's just, like, put a noun here, put a verse here, like, anything like that. And I've always wondered how, like, people are able to put down just their day-to-day life, and it sounds so interesting, because, like, I feel like you get so used to the monotonous, like, way of your life, and you just, like, feel like the things that you're experiencing really aren't that special. And I feel like I get that way a lot of times, but really everybody's experiencing a different thing at all, like, at any given time. So, like, if I'm able to just write down these random thoughts that I think about, and I, like, I'll just rant, like, I'll show them to people, and they'll be like, well, man, that's good. And I'm just like, well, it's just something that was going on in my life, so I don't really see it as that special. So, like, in that process, I'm constantly making, like, voice memos, messages, or I'm sending texts to my wife and having her save them, or having her text me different things. But I feel like art comes to you, and that's the biggest thing.
So you start off with one, like, this, like, one random thing that occurs in, like, a, say, one day, and then have another thing that happens maybe 2 to 3 days later.
Yeah.
What's the process like for you to, like, actually, like, take these, like, 1 to 2, like, lines and then formulate them into, like, actual structured poem?
I feel like, time management, really. A little, like, well, that sounds kind of weird saying it, but, I recently changed my degree to a rhetoric and writing degree with a focus in creative writing, and every week you have to have a poem ready. So, like, it's like crunch time, and, like, so I'm taking these things that I'm saying, and, like, the hardest part is starting for me. So I'm taking a lot of these things that I'm saying or I'm writing down, and, like, I've got to ask myself, why did I write that down? Why did I feel that way in a specific situation? Why would that be something that came to my mind in a day-to-day thing? Is there a reason for it? Is there more meaning to this than what I just put down or just a random thought? And then from there, I'm able to slowly strip down the layers of myself into what I might honestly be feeling. Because, like, the biggest part with why I started writing was because I couldn't talk to anybody. Like, I couldn't find myself. In one of my poems, I say that I would just scream to my passenger's car and, like, pretend that God was there, because I didn't have any friends. I didn't have anybody that I could confide in. So I started doing this with my journals. I started being able to just spill everything onto them. And it wasn't until I got married that, like, I would actually talk to my wife. And, like, a lot of the times I would just write stuff down, because that was the most comfortable way to do it. And I believe spoken word actually helped me out a lot with being able to say the things as well. Like, and I believe that helped me out for whenever I did get married and things along those lines. But ultimately, I went on a tangent. I feel like stringing those things together, like, comes with, like, ripping off the layers of yourself that you're afraid to see. A lot of that stuff that you're afraid to see is the stuff that people need to hear.
Sure. All right, man. So, we talked a lot about structure. We talked a lot about your creative process. And I want to now put something into people's hands that they can check out more of. So, where can people find you online?
I would say at Cherokee Land. That's CHEROKEELANN. On Instagram, and you'll be able to find everything in my description there. Like, everything that I ever have, you can have. And on there, there's, like, a little booking email. Email me that, I can give you anything you could possibly need that I have, even unreleased stuff.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
I appreciate it, man. It was a really good interview.
All right. I'm sitting here now with Laura, vocalist in the band Comrades. How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a long day. It's been a day filled with awesome music.
Yeah. There's a lot of great bands out there.
All right, so you guys are actually getting ready to do your... You guys are on the heels of your second Face Down release. And before we jump into that, for those that may not have ever heard of Comrades before, tell us a little bit about you guys.
I guess we're technically a post-rock.
You guys have been at this a long time. I think the very few bands that we have had on our show maybe been together 3 to 5 years. You guys have been at this like 10 years, maybe more, longer?
Yeah. Yeah, so technically it was the very end of 2009 that changed the name of the band that Joe and I used to be in. It's Comrades. So 2009 was officially the new name. Comrades. So, yeah, 10 years. Almost months away.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
So, what is it about the creative process of Comrades that makes you guys just want to keep putting together music?
I think that individually, I feel like all of us know we're really privileged. Like, we, John, who's Paige, who's president, he's only been with the band since we've known him for years and years, and all of us, like, knowing him and then Joe and I both, and we all feel like music is just a part of who we are, and if we don't do it, like, something's missing. And individually, we all have expressed that feeling. So with the new record, I guess I can just mention that because that's like what we created today. It was really just beautiful in a way because we all respect each other's talents and we also respect each other's opinions. And so when we got together, it was so easy. Like, and I'm not saying that we wrote things that weren't easy because it was just like, oh, we can make this easy. Well, no, it was like the way that we clicked and the way that, I mean, there would be moments where we're just in the basement, like, trying so hard to get a part to just fit into the other part of the song. And the transition wasn't coming into our brains, so we're just frustrated. And we would just be like, you know, it's fine. Let's go, like, watch an episode of The Office and, like, come back in 30 minutes. Like, it'll be fine. And that's how we got through it. Like, that's how a lot of our music, because, like, Joe would write his parts, and then Joe and John would get together, and I would just sit and, like, listen and be like, what is this trying to say? What does it mean? And, like, where can I fill in the gaps and build bridges? Because I think that's, like, really beautiful about this. Be the thing. You can be both of them and the other. So, like, musically, I think there was just, I don't know, a lot of our process was built on just trusting.
So this new album is called For We Are Not Yet, We Are Only Becoming, and like we previously said, this is the second release you guys have done with Face Down. This is your third album under labels, because you guys have been around a while. But what is the writing process like for this album, being that you guys, this is the first one where you guys have sat together in a room and
How does the writing process differ from other records?
I think we, like, Joe and I both, our writing process is pretty similar. I think there was a lot more frustration and struggle in the last record, just with, I think there was a lot of pressure to, because it was the first grace of release, and we were like, well, what do we need to do to make this? And so I feel like there's a lot of weight in that when we were writing our last release. We had a different things for us, and it was just, every person's different. And there's a lot of different things and factors that were going on. So I think that just was a different ballgame, than writing this. It was like, we all knew what we wanted in, like, overarching theme-wise and that kind of stuff. And one of the things, in both records, we definitely wanted the music to say what the music needed to say. But I think coming into this, there was a lot of release from just that worry about if it's going to be good or if it's going to be enough or whatever it is. That was such a focus on the last record. And I know that that doesn't come across because we still wanted it to be, we still wanted it to be like authentic and not forced and that kind of stuff with Lone Gray. And I think those songs ended up the way that they should have been. And I don't think that in any way feels like the frustration doesn't feel like those things, which is great, because that's not what we want it to convey. But with this new record, for us, to kind of have yourself settled into what you wanted and move forward in that, rather than like worrying about what other people are going to think about it. All musicians have that reel going on in their head when they write a record. They're like, oh my gosh, is this gonna make it? Like, is this gonna be something that people are interested in? Like, what do we do if it sounds like this and we change this? Like, is this going to be accepted? And with this record, we just find a lot of confidence in each other and like what we're doing, and the music just feels like what our hearts wanted to say. And so I think we've grown enough over the past, that record came out in 2016, so the past 3 years, like, we've just grown a lot into what we are as comrades and what we want to be. So the new record definitely, I felt like in the writing process, we experienced those things more so than the last one.
So you talk about overarching themes for this album. What kind of themes are you guys looking to tackle with this new release?
So for We Are Not Yet, We Are Only Becoming is, it's a George MacDonald quote. I felt like, honestly, that summarized it. Like, the way that I've been reading a lot of Brené Brown. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's an excellent author that talks a lot about various parts of human emotions. But one of the things that struck me was that struggle is a part of our story, and we all love stories that have like the underdog or like, an insurmountable obstacle that you're supposed to, you watch this person in 2 hours go through, and they end up overcoming in the end. But we love those stories because then, 2 hours later, you watch this person go from, the gutter to on top of the world. But in reality, like, our lives have those stories too, and we just have to really recognize that, the way things are is not the way they'll always be. This is a process. Like, we are in our story, and our stories might have a smaller, arc for the storyline. We might have like smaller bumps rather than this giant, grandiose, cinematic storyline going on, but that's where we are. And every part of our story is, we have choices to make, and they make us who we are and what we're going to be at the end. So I think with this new record, I definitely felt like in the past 3 years that I experienced so many things, and I grew in ways, and I recognized things that needed to be dealt with in my life because of those things. So I think with For We Are Not Yet, I just want people to recognize and realize that you don't have to get stuck where you are. You don't have to let circumstances necessarily trap you and define you. Like, there's always going to be a future as long as you keep walking forward. And, you know, letting those things pass through are shaping you. But, I don't know, we still, we're always in the process. And,
No, 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 and you're on a show that, you know, we are constantly telling people to move forward, because we deal exclusively with mental health, so, like, we talk a lot about, like, you know, depression is only a season, or anxiety is, it can only be a season. Like, if you push those through that forward, it doesn't have to be the end of you.
Yeah, and I mean, I have songs that deal specifically with, like, emotional abuse. I have songs that deal with depression. I have songs that deal with just fear. But also, like, in every one of those songs, like, all those emotions are not, they are not a thing that has to impact you. You know? I think, as like, comrades, as a band, we've always wanted to leave people with a sense that there's always hope. And Joe used to say it from stage all the time, like, see truth, there's always hope. Like, those are two things that we, as a band, have adopted. And, I mean, and there's always days where you just feel like those things are harder to see than others. But, I mean, in the track Faultlines, like, one of the lines I say is, like, remember the way things, like, how present they are, and always how they're going to be. Like, that's, like, such a huge aspect of being able to helpfully move through difficult things. And, you know, mental health is, like, it's one of those things that you have bad days, you have good days, and you have to remember, like, getting through it. It's like, there's going to be another side, always. And so...
So let's talk about this. Let's talk about the musical sounds that are going to make up this album. Okay. Like, how do you guys progress, musically speaking?
I mean, we're still guitar bass drums. There's one song that's piano bass, which, I mean, if anyone's listening to our first record that we put out on Blunt Ink Records, it's called Safekeeper. The big thing is piano. But I think musically it's just, I mean, it doesn't deviate from those lines, but I think we were more okay with letting the music grow into a space where we were like, we don't have to be friends. Like, we don't have to feel like we need to impress people. Like, we just need to do what we do well. And so, and then that comes with maturity. And so, you know, to not just having to be like flashy and whatever it is. And like, I love, like, we love Matthew parts, like, all that, those little things, like, intricate stops and dynamic. But I thought musically, like, we just, there was more flow, if that makes sense, which feels like I'm getting into, like, the yoga thing, but just seriously, like, just letting it move the way that it feels like it should move, and trusting that, like, the music is bigger than us, and that's okay, and it's okay for us to not have to, like, force some crazy time signature onto it, you know? It just is, and that's fine. So, I think musically it's, when I listen to it, I feel a lot of peace, but I don't know if that's because I know how well and how just how much ease was involved in the recording process and, like, getting everything done. I mean, I spent, gosh, I mean, I say that, and then I was like, oh yeah, there was that week where I just spent, like, 8 hours a day in a basement, like, staring at the computer screen, hitting the space bar, like, writing lyrics. Because I went in with, like, 11 songs, and like, 6 of them fit over 10 of the songs that we had. So I was just like, oh, and so I had to write 4 songs. Well, more than that, 4.5 songs. Really, because, you know, I had, like, lines written down from journals, and I went through all of this stuff. But, yeah, even so, the music, like, that aspect of it, there's so much ease in it, really. And so hopefully people can just feel like that it's solid and that we did our best in it. So I feel like really that, like, utilized, like, the highlights of all of our different talents and supported each other in those things. And so hopefully that is conveyed.
When you talk about the pressure of being off with this being the second album of Face Down, you guys talked about the pressure of, you know, Blood and Ink compared to Face Down.
Yeah.
It's a bigger label
in
the community, and, you know, obviously with that big move, you felt that pressure, and you talked about that. And so now with it, Lone Grey being so well received, don't feel that pressure anymore, really, with kind of moving into this new world.
I mean, I think that it's always scary when you put out for new things.
Absolutely.
Because there's still unknown. You don't know if someone's going to be like, oh, I have to say that. You know, some people, and obviously some people are going to be like, it's great, but then some people aren't going to like it. And that's fine. Like, people are, and they're capable of making decisions that affect their own lives. But, like, I think, like, with music, we knew the lyrics, they were our friends, like, little kids, and so the pressure there was mostly just, like, making sure that it was done well, and then moving to Face Down, that was when we introduced, like, vocals on every song, and we were screaming, and we were screaming, and so it pushed all of us further, I think. I know, but this reason why you say that it's less, like, there is a pressure because you want to do well for the people that are putting themselves out there for you, but I would say that, and also, like, we're so proud of what you've done, that I'm, like, excited to share it with people. And, like, my excitement is overcoming my fears and my reservations about what it's going to be. Because I'm just like, I love these songs. I think we did really great with them. Like, I'm not really sitting here being like, oh no, like, what if everyone hates me? This is something that I feel very strongly about that I did, and this is what it's supposed to be. So, like, let's go. Let's just do it. And I want to show these people songs. It's really hard because, like, I just want to give it all out to people that I love. Just kind of like, listen to our new record, you know? We can't do that because not a lot of the exes, you know. It just feels so much brighter almost because the excitement is just
like, don't get it close to me. It's like, oh, it's.
All right, so we are not yet, we're only becoming, it drops June 7th. But if you guys go to victimsandvillains.net/reviews, you guys can actually hear our thoughts on the record. Surprise. All right. Well, where can people find you guys and your music? All right, well, enjoy some Comrades music. We'll be right back.
Beautiful and sings to me songs of the